we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
And that's the song Media Wars, a collage. To begin our program this week, discussing the media in America and in the world with prominent people in the media who are actually doing it and can share their experiences and their perspectives. All of this is for MediaChannel.org, where you'll be able to find the podcast of this interview. Joining me today, a journalist I have a great deal of admiration for, Jason Leopold, an investigative reporter known for many years for his work at Truthout as a senior editor and reporter, but now a contributor to Al Jazeera America, AJAM as it's known, based in Los Angeles and doing investigative reporting on a lot of the issues that I'm particularly interested in, national security issues, Guantanamo, the NSA, and other related issues. And we'll be talking about that with Jason Leopold. Jason, welcome. How are you today?
Doing well. Great to be with you, Danny. Thanks for having me on.
Very hot here in New York, and maybe it'll get a little hotter as we continue our conversation. I'm very impressed with your ability to carve out a niche for yourself at a time when other journalists like Len Greenwald and his crew seem to be getting all the attention. You've had a number of really solid scoops on this national security crisis, and I want to go into detail on
them. Sure.
But first, let's let our listeners and Media Channel readers know a little bit more about your background, how you became a journalist, what inspired you, and what drives you still to be involved in an industry which is, shall we say, very challenging today.
Yeah, to say the least. Well, you know, I got my start as a journalist back in the early 90s. I had actually had my first job writing obituaries for a newspaper in White Plains, New York. And that was a great gig because, you know, it taught me how to extract information out of people when they were at their most vulnerable. You know, the survivors of people who passed away. So, you know, teaching a journalist to have empathy, sympathy, and it is very, very important. So I had appreciated that. As far as, you know, what got me into journalism or, you know, what got me into it, why I wanted to do it, I don't know, Danny. I mean, I had always had this passion for, you know, chasing the truth, chasing some injustice. In fact, you know, a funny story is I happened to have pulled out my high school yearbook recently for some reason to take a look. I was in a conversation with a friend, and
you haven't aged. You haven't aged at all. Okay, look at that picture in your high school. You look exactly the same, man.
Well, you know, I the funny thing is that someone actually wrote to me, you know, when you get people to sign your yearbook and that it said, "Dear Jason, I hope you become a good journalist one day." So it was really nice to actually see that because it was a reminder that I had that passion and, you know, for journalism, you know, way back when. And, you know, moving sort of, you know, forward, I live in Los Angeles now, and I've been here for quite some time. And so, you know, the type of work that I do on the national security counterterrorism beat, if you will, is very challenging because I'm not in New York or D.C. where you have immediate access to those, you know, to those sources.
Or not, as the case may be, because
or
it
not,
seems
exactly.
as that a lot of these people clam up and don't really want to talk to reporters, send you to their PR people and their flacks and find ways to dissemble when asked direct questions. And so perhaps having the distance and the independence, in a sense, of not being part of the pack enables you to look at things with fresh eyes.
I think it does. And then, you know, I enjoy where I am. I don't want to, you know, I kind of want to remain an outsider. I don't want to be, you know, directly in there. But some of my, some of my heroes, the people that I look up to as journalists, for example, I.F. Stone is one. And one thing that I had learned, you know, from I.F. Stone and reading his work was that, you know, you can find these incredibly important nuggets of information in the public record if you simply take the time to look. And that's what he had done.
Stone never went to press conferences. He wasn't part of the White House Correspondents Association or any similar body. But his weekly in Washington, when he put out the I.F. Stone Weekly, always was breaking news that was ignored or deliberately, you know, omitted in major newspapers. And I think he won his reputation as, a major member of the American media through the persistence of his dedication to getting the facts, which is something that is an art that many have abandoned. I mean, you worked at the City News Service in Chicago, I think, right?
I worked at the one in L.A.
But, you know, that required
a certain amount
of discipline and being in the court system and understanding, what decisions are, what testimony is. This requires, you know, attention to detail is what I'm trying to get at, which I think tends to be ignored by many who prefer the sweeping statement and vision.
Yeah, I thank you for, you know, taking note of that. I agree. You know, when I did work at City News Service, I was basically, you know, my office was inside of the, you know, the civil courthouse in downtown Los Angeles. And then this was great because my love of journalism really sort of goes back to that, you know, old days of journalism where, you know, you would a story would break, you'd get on the phone and you'd call it into your editor, you know, a sort of romantic, you know, world that, you know, that existed at one time, you know, people going down to the local bar and talking about the stories or, you know, tipping the bartender and find out some news. So it was a very, important, hands-on, learning experience that I had there because, you know, I would basically go through the daily court filings to find the news. You know, that's what my job was. Look through these lawsuits, try to find something that, you know, would be newsworthy to, you know, a general audience in LA and hopefully national.
Before it became news in, let's say, the L.A. Times or other major news outlets, because you're dealing with the data, the documentation, the claims and counterclaims in a court setting.
Yeah, this was anything that I did was breaking news. So I would be the one that would break the news, you know, if it was something and then it was a wire service, then they'd send it out to the L.A. Times. But it was that experience of literally handling documents, searching, you know, digging, that, I felt that I could duplicate that, certainly on a, you know, on a national scale and duplicate it in the same way that, you know, Izzy Stone had when he would, you know, dig through government documents and find that those nuggets of information. So, you know, I certainly have been very fortunate over the years with landing, some scoops that came from literally documents that are right up on government websites now.
And you took on some big stories. I mean, let's acknowledge that. You took on the energy crisis in California. You took on Enron. And in many ways, and you took on safety issues at BP. You took on the United States Air Force, okay? You've taken on Guantanamo. These are not, you know, small targets. And the empire, in a way, has struck back at you. You've been denounced in some quarters as being inaccurate, a plagiarist, blah, 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 blah. I mean, how do you cope with that? You know, obviously, we all make mistakes. So, you know, saying that. But it does seem as if you're being an assertive, aggressive reporter. You've been called the Freedom of Information Act terrorist, okay, because of your due diligence in that area. At the same time, you've, you know, as you criticize big institutions, they tend to find ways to criticize or try to neutralize you.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I do want to acknowledge that, you know, I am human. I have made mistakes as a journalist. I've owned up to them. You know, they're all out there for anyone to see. But, you know, the key for me was that I knew, you know, part of it, let me back up for a minute. Part of it was, you know, was being naive in a sense. So if you're taking on a powerful, you know, institution or even a powerful political figure like Karl Rove, you have to make sure that, you know, that, you know, if you're going to go after the king, that you really, you know, are able to, you know, take that person down, you know, that institution down, that and that individual down, that, you know, there's nothing that, you know, can be sort of left there that, you know, they can come back to.
So what happens? Do people leak information to you or sources tell you things that, that you know, you didn't confirm or couldn't confirm, perhaps? You went with it perhaps because the person you relied on was credible on other stories, and then you found yourself out on a branch.
That's exactly it. I mean, it was, you know, it was having a complete faith in sources. And again, that's, you know, that was wrong. I mean, that, you know, having a complete 100% faith in a source that the information you're getting is accurate and just going out there. And, you know, much of my experience as a journalist came from hands-on learning experience. You know, I went to NYU. You know, I didn't finish NYU, but, you know, I attended the school. And, you know, my first job, as I indicated, was, you know, was writing op-eds. And so everything that I learned as a journalist was really from hands-on experience. And that includes making those mistakes. So, you know, I feel I'm in a unique position. And I don't feel that, you know, it's bad that I made mistakes. As I indicated, I'm human. Not everything is going to be right.
You've owned up to it, including your drug addiction, for example. I was on with David Carr here on Media Channel of the New York Times, and he was on welfare, you know, and he was, you know, a drug user. And he admits it. And I think it helped him become a better journalist and have more compassion and sympathy for people who tend to get this discarded in our society and just, you know, put down without any compassion whatsoever about what they're coping with.
It's true. I mean, well, you know, let me just say, I wrote a book about it, you know, called News Junkie. And it's about how my, you know, personal life informed my professional life. You know, I'm a former addict. I've been sober for 16 years. That was, you know, a part of my life that I really felt I wanted to share with people. You know, what made me tick, how those personal sort of demons in a way, you know, informed my, you know, well, professional life.
You know, in our business, everybody's always talking about credibility, okay? And somehow, you know, you're supposed to be a saint, okay? At the same time, your credibility is actually enhanced when you acknowledge that you went through certain rough times and certain problems because so many millions of your readers and your viewers have had the same experience. And I think they will respect you more for being forthcoming about it.
Well, I hope so, and I appreciate you saying that. I mean, it's always been, you know, certainly in the areas one is writing in, or what, excuse me, in the area that I'm writing in, where, you know, it is dealing with sensitive information and dealing with individuals, you know, I was naive to the fact that, hey, I'm writing about someone, I'm exposing them, while, you know, I've got these skeletons in my own closet that they can certainly use to try to discredit me. And, you know, as I said, you know, it took a point where it, I had to sort of, you know, grow up and realize that. And I felt, you know, I felt an obligation not just to my readers or the public, to myself to sort of, you know, talk about that and, you know, talk about my personal life, because it had a completely other life, Danny. I mean, I used to work in the music business, used to be a music business,
right,
you know,
exactly.
And, you know, but journalism had always been something that I had gravitated towards, you know, the fact that there was, you know, that there were these injustices happening. And I think that is the common thread that anyone can find all of my work.
I wrote a book and have made films about Nelson Mandela. Okay.
Somebody I was
fortunate to get to know. And one of the things that he was always saying is, you know, I was not a saint. You know, a saint is a sinner, he said, who keeps on trying. Okay.
Yeah. Perfect.
He was very clear about this, and he wrote a book of his own confessions because he didn't want to be deified. He didn't want to seem as if he was perfect and everybody else wasn't. And in some ways, I think people loved him for that, even though publicly they wouldn't sort of acknowledge it. They didn't want to acknowledge it because they wanted to believe that he was, in a sense, you know, somebody who had supernatural powers. But he was very clear that he didn't, that he was a member of an organization, that it was collectively managed and run. He didn't try to puff himself up. He had a great deal of humility, and I think that in the end was the trait that people admired the most.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, and thanks for sharing that. And I felt that, you know, or I feel that, you know, hopefully if I'm able to sort of, you know, share my own vulnerabilities, it would, you know, perhaps, first of all, it was for me, but it also would, you know, would have that sort of same effect for, you know, for my readers.
But we're in a political time when, you know, in a sense, no quarter is given. We're in a polarized political environment where people don't disagree with somebody. They consider them an enemy to be destroyed. Okay? It's the politics of personal destruction. And they're
looking for
something that can, you know, expose somebody and bring them down in a way that never allows them to come back up. And we saw this in Mississippi. A man committed suicide because he went into a nursing home to try to get the facts or build up a story about a political opponent. I mean, this is dirty, vicious politics. And in our media system, it's very much present, you know, where people, one false move, one slip, one fact that isn't confirmed, and suddenly your whole life could be, you know, completely torn apart. And many of our bosses in the media, you know, are not going to really stand by you very long if there's some reason to suspect that your credibility has been, you know, questioned, or on some other level, you know, you have an agenda, you know, that other people don't have, and therefore you're not an objective journalist. I mean, you've heard all this.
Yes, I have. I mean, I hear it all the time. You know, people judging, you know, sort of where I am or you know, what I lean toward or where I lean toward, you know, just based on, you know, on what I write. You know, let me also just add here that, you know, in terms of, you know, my personal life, you know, ever being the consummate journalist, you know, and when I put this book together, News Junkie, you know, that I wanted to have the opportunity to, quote, break my own story, you know, if you will, rather than have someone else sort of find out this, you know, this information that I hadn't shared, and put it out there. So, you know, that was the part of the reason that I, you know, that I did that. But it also was, you know, for me to just say, you know, there it is. There's nothing you can now say about me that I haven't already said about myself. And I've read David Carr's book, and I, you know, Night of the Gun, and I think it's a, you know, it's an incredible book, and I kind of feel I'm happy to be in that company. I
was very pleased that he came on our program and talked to me. He won an award. He was willing to, you know, chat some more. You know, I took up issues about the New York Times. He was a kind of a New York Times loyalist. You know, it's the company he's working for, and he respects his colleagues and, you know, doesn't like cheap shots or quick shots across the bow of the New York Times. Okay. But at the same time, he speaks with a great deal of insight, in part because he had personal experiences that he's acknowledged. And he has a compassion, you know, for people who are on welfare, people who are poor, people who are, you know, not in the limelight, so to speak. You know, we like to think of people in the media as such a sexy business. As you know, it isn't.
No, it isn't. And, you're absolutely right about all of that. And yet I'm still here. I'm still trying to do that.
I want to talk with you about what you've been working on. And I'm hoping you'll stay with us for the next half hour because there's a number of issues that I want to get into with you. You know, the big investigation of du jour, if you will, in the last year followed the Edward Snowden revelations and disclosures that pushed the NSA into, public attention and, you know, in the center of a battlefield, basically, about the work that it's doing and what's accurate about it, with it trying not to reveal anything, not to disclose anything, and at the same time to, you know, attack its critics. And at the same time, you know, we just had the recent NSA director who, you know, basically downplayed for his own reasons Edward Snowden's revelations. You know, the former director was saying, oh, my God, this is, you know, totally, this is, you know, basically not only treason, but worse. Okay. And this guy, the new director, was basically saying, well, we can handle all this. It's no big deal. You know, kind of minimizing, a different strategy to minimize Snowden, to make him make his contribution seem insignificant. So it seems as if the NSA itself is going back and forth, to and fro, trying to figure out what plays best with the public.
Yes, that's exactly what they're doing. In fact, to get into that a bit, I mean, it's been a year. So when the revelations first surfaced last June, I wanted to have an opportunity to report on it as well, Danny. So, what can I do? I don't have someone, and this is sort of representative of, you know, of my work in general. I don't have someone, who is dumping X number of pages of classified documents in my lap, but you know, what I do have is the Freedom of Information Act, and I have, you know, used the Freedom of Information Act to break many of these stories.
Explain to people who may not be aware of the importance of this particular legislation and how it is used as an investigative tool. I mean, I used it just to find out that the government was, in fact, spying on me years ago. So, what they released was blacked out. There was a couple of nice nuggets, you know, in it. But at least they were forced to come clean to some degree. And then, of course, they sanitized what they gave me. But you're using it for another purpose, not simply to, look into your own past, but to try to see what we can find out about these agencies. And one story that you did that I think impressed a lot of people was you got hold of some letters between private, internet companies like Google and the NSA that showed a degree of familiarity, a degree of warmth between the head of the NSA and the head of Google. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, I had asked I had filed a Freedom of Information Act request with, the NSA, basically asking, you know, this is the great thing about the Freedom of Information Act, Danny, is that you can ask for anything. They don't have to give it to you. The government does not have to give it to you, but you can.
But okay.
And they don't, but you can ask. You can certainly ask for it. So I asked for any emails between Keith Alexander and Silicon Valley executives. What I received was, a couple of emails, the first sort of interim release, that showed, you know, I analyzed this. So it's sort of the way the emails were written back and forth, it showed this sort of very, very friendly relationship between Keith Alexander and the executives, the top executives at Google. And this was a an email that was in the context of these meetings that were going to take place between the NSA and Google to address these cyber threats.
So in essence, you start out with this issue of cyber threats, okay? And,
right.
And they send you some information that doesn't really, it's not too revealing about the substance of that issue necessarily. But the tone of the emails calls themselves to your attention. You notice a certain sort of palsy-walsy back and forth
right.
between them, which other people either wouldn't have noticed or wouldn't have commented on.
That's exactly true. I mean, I saw that, you know, you see the way that, you know, Eric Schmidt or Sergey Brin is, you know, from Google addressing Keith Alexander. And it, you know, left the impression that these guys have spoken before. They're friendly. They've met before.
They're on a first name basis.
Yes. But what you just, you know, indicated there or what you just sort of, you know, led into was, you know, they're not too revealing. But here's what's great about the Freedom of Information Act, and here's what's great about these particular documents. So they were not too revealing in terms of what it disclosed. It did. I was able to break some news as a result of it because it provided some information about, you know, about these meetings that took place, where they took place. But it also provided just, you know, a bit more information about what the program was that NSA and the Silicon Valley executives were working on. So that led me to file another Freedom of Information Act, you know, the Meta FOIA, if you will, another Freedom of Information Act request to get information about that particular program. But, you know, what I also was hoping that people would sort of take away from that particular story, Danny, is the fact that here you have the NSA, you know, spying and allegations there, you know, they've got access to, you know, the emails of everyone. And here I am using this, you know, this tool, and I got Keith Alexander's emails, and I thought that was pretty cool. You know?
He was probably spying on you, and you, for at least this quick moment, was spying
right,
on
right.
him. But, you know, again, you know, this is like as a college student, I would go in the days that we went to libraries instead of online to find anything out, you know, you would go to the stack, so to speak, of a great university library like I did at Cornell. And I would go looking for a particular book. And then I would find next to that book another book that I hadn't even known existed, which was more revealing than what I was actually looking for. And so in some ways, this is a process investigative journalism. It's not trying to get the big, scoop with one email, but it gets you into understanding how they think about this issue, how they relate to each other about it. It gets you into learning how to ask deeper questions.
Yeah, it's important to note that this is true investigative work. I mean, as I said, you know, you get one email. Well, do you end the story there? You know, they were talking about this program called the Enduring Security Framework. And the Enduring Security Framework is, you know, a program.
Can just call it the ESF, okay? I
mean, ESF, okay.
You know,
so,
since we're insiders.
You know, DHS is involved, you know, Department of Defense. And the NSA, and it's the work that they do with these cyber, with these tech companies, you know, to address cyber threats. So I don't have any information on that, but this email provided me with the information that I needed to make another request, which I already have made, and I hope to get, you know, some material so I can, you know, write a bigger story. That's how, you know, the investigative process works.
So
use FOIA.
So a lot of your efforts. So tell us about now, how do you actually do this? Then we're going to take a break. But how do you actually use FOIA? What does that mean, use FOIA? Sending an email, sending a letter? What does it say? How do you word it? Whatnot?
Well, you know, I mean, as I indicated, first of all, let me just note that July 4th is the 48th anniversary of the Freedom of Information Act request. Of the Freedom of Information Act. A law that Johnson reluctantly signed. and the way that I use it is I try to identify material that I cannot access simply by calling up a government agency and saying, hey, can you send over this document? That never happens anymore, Danny. Even for material that's not classified, to ask any government agency for, you know, a document, they simply will refuse to give it. So it forces me to, you know, since I was, as I said, I'm not getting material leaked, forces me to find out or to figure out another way to get it. So, you know, the Freedom of Information Act basically says you can ask for anything, you know, under the law. Because it is a law that you can request from a government agency records that they maintain, that they hold, that they have, and by law they have to respond to me, the requester, within, you know, 3 weeks or so. And usually what happens is they, you know, they say, well, we need more time, or, you know, we can't respond to you in the time frame that you that were required. So sometimes it takes, you know, quite a bit more time to get that.
But you also reported that they, the NSA itself, say there's been a surge of similar requests, and it's overwhelming their capacity to respond. At least the few people they have assigned to this.
That's actually one of my favorite requests, and I'm glad. Thank you for bringing that up. So after the
Snowden, I'm paying attention here,
yeah,
Jason.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, Danny.
Thank you.
So it's one of my favorite requests because after the Snowden leaks, if you recall, there was we found out about the PRISM program and other programs, and I wanted to know how. There were several things I wanted to know. One, I wanted to know how is the NSA, which is virtually exempt from FOIA, because everything the NSA does, for the most part, is classified. It's classified under, you know, a presidential executive order, or it's just classified under, you know, in general under, you know, national security. So when you ask the NSA for, you know, for material, generally they issue what's known as a glomar, can neither confirm nor deny.
Now, I will tell you one thing, and I'm going to come back to this in a minute because we have to take a break. But I've been doing a television series about the NSA and about the American surveillance state. And after CBS 60 Minutes managed to get into the NSA to do a bunch of, you know, kind of, I wouldn't call it really serious reporting, but nevertheless, the NSA hosted them. I wrote to the NSA and said, look, I would like to take advantage of your openness here and come in with my own crew. Okay. I never got a response so quickly saying no. Okay.
Yeah.
From an NSA official.
It was like,
you know, what? Forget about it. We'll be back in a minute with more. We're talking with the Jason Leopold, now with Al Jazeera, an investigative reporter. He's got a lot to say and he's had a lot of experiences that are quite fascinating. Stay with us.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Sandy stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson abandoned Baden.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media...
Danny Schechter, your news dissector here with Jason Leopold, investigative reporter, and now working with Al Jazeera. We've been talking about the NSA and some of his investigations. As you know, Jason, recently Glenn Greenwald sort of published a rather cryptic tweet saying that the story that he had promised to break, that would he compared it to fireworks in the skies, July 4th style, had to be researched more carefully. That led to a recent story on Op-Ed News suggesting that his story has been squashed or in some way interfered with. The suggestion was that perhaps Pierre Omidyar, the person who funded First Look Media, might be interfering. There was no evidence suggesting it, and Greenwald has not commented about it. I'm wondering what you think may be going on there, because I'm sure you're closely following these revelations and disclosures.
Sure. I mean, let me just say, I don't have any insight into, I followed what you just described, but I don't have any insight into, what's been happening. I would have a very hard time believing that, Glenn Greenwald would cave or a story would be stopped by anyone. He just does not strike me as the individual that would ever allow anything that he's written to be spiked. However, with that said, let me just add that I understand, journalists sort of going out there and sort of, giving a little tease to their work. I found it to be, foolish to go out and make these grand claims about what you're going to report, so far in advance. I don't know what the purpose of that was. And part of the problem with that is that when you make these grand promises, it never ever lives up to what people expect it to be. So it could end up being a dud, even if it is, a big deal.
I wondered about this too, about the psychology of this, because the NSA has at points been given to a bit of boasting about its capacity, its capability, its, commitment to collect it all, collect everything that there is in the world. It's arrogance in many ways towards, the people who are the targets of its quote collections and all the rest of
right.
it. And then to see a sort of counter bragging, if you will, by Greenwald seemed out of character. I didn't really understand it either, what his purpose was. I mean, there's one thing, you have a big story coming up, you want to hype it a little bit. But if you overdo it, you raise expectations well beyond your ability to meet them. And in this particular case, obviously, they didn't have everything nailed down. Apparently, they went to the government. He writes in his book about when he worked with the Guardian would go to the government for comment on stories that he was about to reveal or they were about to reveal, and they'd have to wait for the government to respond. The government often didn't want to respond, if you will. But
right.
Here's a case where the government apparently has responded in some way to something that they've been told, and they're suggesting, and Greenwald is saying, have raised some questions and we need to do more investigation. So it's weird that an investigation takes place in public this way without any detail. It's allusions to something going on, and it leads to, sort of this article on Op-Ed News, and I'm sure in other places, challenging them. There's now a report that all of the documents that on another website, that all of the documents that Snowden disclosed are going to be, quote, dumped on the internet in a sort of WikiLeaks style, the way was done with some of the disclosures that Chelsea Manning revealed.
Yeah, that was on Cryptome, and that actually, Cryptome, which is a very old clearinghouse type website that's been there for a long time. That's actually not going to happen. They made a tweet, or they tweeted about the fact that these documents will be dumped. It was misinterpreted. Given social media, it picked up, it snowballed, and people thought that they had access to these. To these materials. They don't have access to the materials as far as I can tell, but just getting back to what you were saying here, I mean, look, people are waiting, they're watching Greenwald. I cannot imagine what he is going through from every direction. I mean, the guy is walking around, I don't know where he has it, but with the most highly sensitive, documents that have ever been released. I mean, sensitive, so the fact that
I'm sure that in a year, the NSA has developed some sort of capacity to monitor him more closely.
Sure. And, and I think that there's several things happening here. You talked about the psychology. On one hand, people are waiting. They want to see more. You have, information junkies that just want it out there. Everyone sort of has their own self-serving purpose, right? I think everyone is sort of, what's happening here, wanting to figure it out. I personally, this is why I started by saying this, is that I just wouldn't say anything. For me, it's like, I have a story, I'm going to put it out when it's out. I don't need to spend 2 months telling people how big it's going to be, because that's just my sort of assessment.
Well,
what
that,
if someone else reads it?
In a sense, there's a suggestion here, maybe people work on a story really hard. They believe they own the story. You know, Snowden gave him the documents. He was blessed and whatever. Even though the funny part of the irony of it, of course, as he acknowledges in his book, is that when Snowden asked him to encrypt his email, he didn't have time to do it. He didn't respond to him. You know, he was he sort of almost missed the story. Okay, the scoop of his career. But now he seems like, you know, this has gone to his head a little bit, you know, and I think all the attacks on him by mainstream establishment journalists and right wingers, et cetera, has made him, you know, very, you know, antsy, if you will, and very quick to jump on them and not to recognize, maybe, you know, of course they're going to do that. Of course they're going to try to discredit him.
And like I said, I first of all, don't want to pass any judgment. I've not been in the position that he's been in. I certainly have been in the position where, you know, I have been the recipient of those types of attacks. And I can tell you just my own, you know, personal experience, it's emotionally draining. It's an experience like no other, because you feel like there are people coming at you from every direction. I will say though that you know, he certainly has made, you know, Glenn Greenwald certainly made this statement numerous times, and I find it also to be rather curious. Yes, he does have lots and lots and lots and lots of documents, but you know, beyond the Washington Post, the New York Times, and ProPublica was also given a lot of NSA documents from the Snowden cache from the or by the Guardian. Why has, you know, let's take the New York Times and set them aside for a moment. Why hasn't ProPublica, which actually had access to these documents, why haven't they reported anything except they've reported one story? It's really bizarre.
They recently did this chart. I don't know if you saw it, this big chart with lots of links to various stories about what we know about the NSA disclosures. But it's true. They have not, you know, investigative reporters, when I was certainly in that position at ABC News, you know, we like to advance the story. We like to see what other people are doing and go beyond
it. We just don't see that.
You know, so we're not just competing for the same information. We're trying to get beyond it to bring the story further. And ProPublica, of course, has its roots in the Wall Street Journal. It's a
deep roots in the Wall Street Journal. Yes, and then they also have, you know, a lot of funding. But you know, it's worth asking the question. In fact, you know, I wonder if anyone should, you know, just kind of ask them, you know, what are you guys dealing with this? But you know, you just talked about advancing the story, and so I just wanted to like put out there that one thing that I want to do, or that I have been doing, and again, using FOIA as a way to do this, is to advance that NSA story. And how, you know, have I been doing that is, well, we all know that behind the scenes, right, when this dump was happening, the NSA officials were publicly discussing, you know, talking about these documents, what it meant, the damage. But how do they actually craft that message? And what your listeners should know is that, you know, it's not just someone goes out there, say Keith Alexander, and makes a comment. These messages are crafted. They're talking points, and they're drafted. And I know that because, you know, I've seen what talking points look like, and I know that that's how it works.
And they're reviewed. You know, I was at a New York Times conference about leaks, and all the big investigative, Gelman was there, Laura and Glenn were there via Skype. Glenn was on Skype, too, but all the top New York Times reporters were there. Jill Abramson, when she was the executive editor, was there. So it was and there were two representatives of the national security state there. And we try to interview one of them, a lawyer for the director of national intelligence. You know, he was right there. I had my crew there. I said, can I ask you a few questions? Absolutely not. Okay.
Yeah.
He had a PR guy that came over to me. Well, you can make a request and blah, blah. You know, basically to prevent any sort of spontaneous response.
Exactly. You know. Exactly. And so what I did was very early on, Danny, like I think it was July, I filed a FOIA request with the NSA, and I asked them for all of their talking points related to the Edward Snowden leak, to the leak of documents from Edward Snowden, all of their talking points. And this was very early on when they, you know, the NSA, you gotta, as I indicated, they don't usually get FOIA requests because the programs are classified. But this was right at the surge of, you know, of the FOIA requests that they were receiving, mostly from people who wanted to know if the NSA was spying on them. But I asked for the talking points. And I, you know, a few months later, I actually received the talking points. And one of the key...
You did. You got them. Okay, wow.
Yeah, I got them. I wrote a story on them. And one of the key pieces of information in those talking points, advising people like Keith Alexander what to say, is basically use 9/11. And it says that. 9/11 is a key soundbite, and use that to justify these programs. And I wrote a very, you know, a short story, posted the documents, but that story resonated with people. That's what I would call advancing the story.
How do you account for Keith Alexander going on John Oliver's program on HBO with a comedian who danced all around him?
Because he could control the message, and it's a way for him to sort of, you know, speak to an audience that may only be following the news from, say, CNN, or, you know, not digging deep into it. But it's a way for Keith Alexander to control the message. I mean, he's not going to be asked the tough question.
I don't think it was controlled very much. John Oliver was just all over him and ridiculed him to his face.
Yeah, well, that's, I think that's, you know, that was basically the repercussion from that, is that, you know, he thought that, you know, Alexander, oh, I'm going to go on the show, the comedian, I'll get to, you know, I get to control everything I, you know, I want to say. But, you know, what I mean by mentioning these talking points is that's a great way to sort of advance the story, the documents that you referenced earlier about, you know, how many FOIA requests has the NSA received since the leak of Snowden documents. That was another great one, if I do say so myself, because it really provides the public with insight into the NSA's internal operations. I mean, I actually obtained the emails that went back and forth in which NSA officials discussed how they should respond to people's FOIA requests. That's a story, you know, I reported for The Guardian.
That's fascinating. So, you know, people can Google that, I guess, right? Your story on this.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, there's a lot. Even though we're still, you know, even though we live in a very secretive sort of time where you have the government that refuses to, you know, give up any information about any of its programs or activities, which the people do have the right to know about. And that's the thing. They do have the right to know about, you know, what the government is doing, what's being done in their name. And there's certain things that should remain classified, obviously, but there are ways to access that information. And so for me, I found that using documents, you know, being able to post documents, obtaining documents, is and using that in my reporting resonates certainly with readers in this day and age. They want to see that sort of primary source material.
Now, I was a contributor to Al Jazeera. I work for CNN. I work for ABC News. So I've had a little experience in big media organizations. And you know, Al Jazeera has become even bigger, some say more corporate. And I'm wondering how you fit in there, how you feel about working there, and what it's like for you to work there.
Sure. Well, first, let me just say that I'm a freelancer. I'm not even a staffer there. But I have had nothing but, and this is with Al Jazeera America, and last year, before the launch of Al Jazeera America, I was actually writing for Al Jazeera English. With Al Jazeera America, it's just been nothing but a pleasure, really. I mean, I have, you know, have never in my career, experienced or had the pleasure of dealing with, you know, a team of editors and reporters who have just been so incredibly supportive of my work, you know, and willing to literally get their hands dirty working alongside me. So it's been it's been a pleasant surprise. I really enjoy it, and I appreciate the opportunities that they have given me. So
yeah.
I mean, and these are, you know, editors who and reporters who, you know, come from various mainstream publications, but they all sort of, you know, seem to share the same commitment to the truth.
I mean, let's face it, with Al Jazeera, you have a much, you know, kind of bigger footprint to serve. Your stuff is going to get picked up worldwide. Often you're going to have the backing of a news organization, so you're not just a, you know, an individual out there who can be picked off easily. I think it, you know,
yeah,
gives
and that's
you some
what I
protection.
Actually appreciate was the backing. You know, last summer, Danny, I obtained this was actually leaked, so this wasn't through FOIA, but I obtained the 6 volumes of diaries that were written by the first high-value detainee captured after 9/11, and his name is Abu Zubaydah. This was the detainee who the entire U.S. or the CIA torture program was built around, the first one who was waterboarded and is now one of the captives in Guantanamo. And prior to his capture, he had written a set of diaries that, you know, from 1990 through the 7 days before he was captured in March of 2002. And these were some, you know, I have to say that these are really some of the most important documents to surface, post 9/11, because it provides people with unbelievable insight into the civil war in Afghanistan, the rise of Al Qaeda, the Taliban, what it was, you know, you're getting someone who is literally writing, you know, from his perspective what it was,
but from the inside,
like,
there's
nothing
movement.
Like this out there. I mean, these are, you know, 1,000 pages and nothing like this. And so
were you the publishers want to publish it immediately? Did you get a lot of interest from book publishers?
No, it didn't. And, you know, I mean, that's a whole other world. I mean, there were some that expressed interest, but, you know, the world of book publishing, I'm sure you know, Danny, it's, they look at this as like, well, you know, it's not something that'll sell 500,000 copies. So, you know, there's no interest.
For all that's been said and written about 9/11, the fact that somebody who actually was on the inside has written and writes very well, from what I saw.
It's incredible. I mean, this is a guy who was, I mean, what's really important about this is that, and again, these were documents and, you know, that we published all of them along with, you know, 5 very lengthy pieces that it shows his transformation from engineering student, a computer engineering student to student of jihad. I mean, it's remarkable. I mean, it's cinematic, and there's nothing like it out there.
Hey, man, you live in L.A. Write a script, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe somebody would go for it. I mean, but it's hard to get truth out there. Even in the movies, you know, we saw this with the, the film about it, the CIA torture program, or the overthrow of the Shah of the Shah in Iran, the American embassy there. How sanitized, how entertainment values creep into everything, and how the truth is often distorted in the process of popularizing something. So it's harder and harder to get information to people. I know this from the Nelson Mandela experience. I've written a book about that, you know, to try to get the true story out there. And I think what you're doing, Jason, is really important, because you bring to it the training of a real journalist and, you know, in a way, the experiences of a real mensch, you know, somebody who's actually lived, you know, a deep life with lots of, you know, personal ups and downs. And you can approach these things with, you know, a kind of personal and professional approach that could be very helpful to Americans understanding what's really going on. And I think that this is really important. I think the work you're doing is first rate. I'm really happy that you joined me today on mediachannel.org and on our this program to try to share a little bit of your backstory, so to speak.
Sure.
So people will appreciate your byline.
I really, really appreciate that, Danny. That means a lot to me. You know, I work in L.A. It's kind of, you know, just me out here. So to hear that, you know, well, it's not an easy, it means a lot, and I appreciate it.
My daughter works in the industry, okay?
Right,
so,
sure.
You know, and so much of the reporting out of L.A. is, you know, the TMZ stuff, the entertainment stuff,
right,
and all the rest of it. There are some important, you know, websites like, you know, Truth Dig, published in L.A., Robert Scheer's work and his son's work. That, you know, there are people there who really care about these issues. But to have you there in Al Jazeera and bringing, you know, stories that others have missed to public attention really matters a lot. I'm so happy we managed to hook up this, you know, get together. And I will send you, you know, the actual podcast on mediachannel.org when we have it up. Thank you again.
Thank you, Danny. It's mutual. Thank you so much. And I have great respect for your work as well. And thank you for the kind words and support.
Well, it's good to hear that. Anyway, folks, I hope you enjoy interviews like this one. There are many others on mediachannel.org of people we've spoken to and who have a lot to say, not only about, you know, the issues, but their career and the difficulties of being a journalist today, and who can talk about it from the trenches, you know, not for, from some university platform where they're well rewarded. These people are under the gun all the time. They make a mistake, they're out. You have to respect their willingness to go public and talk to us about all of this. So please check it out. If you want to write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. You know, please keep listening and checking out mediachannel.org. Please, we need your help. Tell your friends about this site. We don't have a big marketing budget, needless to say. We don't have a lot of promotion. We're not doing clickbait. We're not doing all these other, you know, ways to induce more readership. We're trying to do something of substance, and we hope that you will stay with us and that you will appreciate it. Thank you again for listening.
To chase and to walk.